first, you can make it if you try. That's been the assumption in American politics and society for a long time now, with leaders from both parties saying that with enough effort and education, anyone can be successful. But our next guest says that the merit-based view of advancement can leave a lot of people out, and it's used to justify the success of those already at the top. He also says it's led to political resentment from millions of Americans and that the country needs to rethink its attitude towards success to give more people economic power and a democratic voice. Michael Sandel teaches political philosophy at Harvard University. His latest book is The Tyranny of Merit: What's Become of the Common Good. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to be with you, Rob.
Well, your book, Michael, and our conversation center around the concept of meritocracy. So can you start us off with a good working definition?
Well, there are really two. The idea of merit by itself is a good thing. People should be eligible for jobs and social roles not based on prejudice or where they come from or what their background is. That's a good thing. But there's another side of merit that says those who succeed, those who land on top, provided chances are equal, deserve their success and deserve all of the material rewards that come with it. And that's the version of meritocracy that we've been living out in recent decades and that actually has turned out to be corrosive of the common good. It's contributed, I think, to the polarization that afflicts our politics today.
A lot of times, I think, when people talk about meritocracy, and you cite a lot of politicians from different parties through the course of your book, thinking that the concept of meritocracy is good, but maybe it's held up. The wealthy person can pass benefits on to their kid. That interferes with the smooth flowing of meritocracy. Racial discrimination might, if we just get those obstacles out of the way, meritocracy will make for a common good. You don't buy that. You think even a perfectly functioning meritocracy will come out with bad results. Why?
Right. Because those that, and we've seen this in recent decades, Rob, the divide between winners and losers has been deepening, poisoning our politics and driving us apart. And the reason is not just the inequality of income and wealth that we've seen, but also the changing attitudes toward success. Those who've landed on top have come to believe that their success is their own doing, and that by implication, those who struggle, those left out, have no one to blame but themselves. So it generates, I call it meritocratic hubris among the winners, a tendency to forget the luck and good fortune that helped them on their way. And it also produces demoralization, even humiliation among those who left out, who are told they have no one but themselves to blame if they haven't done what it takes to clamber up the ladder of success. That's the dark side of meritocracy, and I think it's playing out in our politics today and fueling the resentment of a great many working people who feel elites have been looking down on them. And this resentment has fueled the populist backlash that we saw in 2016, including the grievances that Trump appeals to.
You say that many people feel the perception that elites have toward them, that a sense of condescension. And as you write, they're not necessarily wrong to feel that way. You cite some examples of, again, leaders from the economic world, the political world in both parties that can be pretty condescending based on that meritocratic ideal. What have we seen?
Yeah, and part of it has to do with the advice that mainstream politicians, Democrats and Republicans alike, have offered working people and middle-class people as the global economy has brought this deepening inequality. The way they've dealt with this inequality has not been to take it on directly, trying to reconfigure the economy to alleviate the inequality. They've taken it on indirectly. They've said, if you want to compete and win in this new global economy, go to college. What you earn will depend on what you learn, the ability to get a diploma. And then you can rise. You can rise as far as your efforts and talents will take you. But you have to get a university diploma. The problem with this is it's great to emphasize college education, to broaden access to college. That's a good thing. But most people in our society, and we forget this, don't have a four-year college degree. Nearly two-thirds of Americans don't. And so to build an economy based on the assumption that dignified work and a decent life depends on a university degree, that's a recipe for disappointment, for exclusion, and for mounting resentment. And I think that's what we've seen.
We're talking to Michael Sandel about his new book, The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of meritocracy and how it works or doesn't work in the United States? Do you feel that our economy is built to reward people with that college degree, that four-year degree, and in some ways to punish those without? Do you think there's a bias in our society against people without that degree? 800-642-1234 is the number. And I want to pursue that point now, Michael. You spent a chapter on this concept that there's an economic bias against people without that college degree, but also kind of a social and prestige bias, a civic bias against them. Talk about how that plays out.
Right. It's a kind of credentialism. And I suggest that in the book, I say that credentialism is, in a way, the last acceptable prejudice. Now, there are still plenty of prejudices throughout our society that give rise to injustice, prejudices based on race and class and gender and ethnicity. But what we don't really face up to is the tendency of well-credentialed, well-educated elites to look down on those who have lesser educational credentials than themselves. And this, I think, rankles, rightly, those who don't have a college degree, but who nonetheless do important jobs, make important contributions to the common good. And Trump has picked up on this. You remember after one of his primary victories in 2016, he said, "I love the poorly educated," because he knew they were voting for him. And the educational divide has become one of the best predictors of partisan allegiance in this country. Trump is alive to this. It's not just a matter of jobs and wage stagnation. It's not just economic inequality that is the source of the anger and resentment. It's also a sense that those who haven't been to university and therefore don't occupy jobs in the professional elite, that somehow the work they do, the lives they live, are less worthy, less admirable. We valorize those who in the professional classes with lustrous credentials. And this denigration, this disparagement of the dignity of work and of working people, I think has been the unacknowledged source of weakness for the Democratic Party. And Trump has exploited it. He's very good at exploiting these grievances.
How do we start to not recreate, but I guess acknowledge the dignity of being an American without that degree? We've done it more in the past, I think. We had, you know, the Abraham Lincolns who did pretty okay, I think. How do we go back to that?
Right. Well, I think one thing we have to do is question the idea, and this has only come in recent decades, that universities are the arbiters of opportunity. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't broaden access to university. I've spent my career in higher education. But do we really want universities to allocate opportunity? They become sorting machines, the universities have, dispensing the credentials and defining the merit that the society rewards and honors, even valorizes. And partly as a result, we have woefully underinvested in forms of learning that most people need and depend on to prepare the world of work, and for citizenship. For example, state colleges, two-year community colleges, forms of vocational and technical training. We underinvest in them, and we don't really accord them the respect that they are due, which gets back to the point you were emphasizing, Rob, about this not only being about economics, it's also about recognition and honor and esteem. This is a point that I try to emphasize in the book, because this is what provokes really the sense of resentment and humiliation among people who feel that not only the economy, but also the culture have left them behind, which is why we need, I think, a renewed emphasis on the dignity of work.
We're talking to Michael Sandel, professor of political philosophy at Harvard, author of the new book, The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You feel like we need to rethink our attitudes about what it means to be successful and what it takes to get there? Do you feel looked down upon by politicians or others, maybe because of the work you do or your educational level? Do those feelings translate into how you vote during elections? What do you think we need to do to bring us together and give us the sense that we're all in this together? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation and hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Michael Sandel, political philosopher and author of the new book, The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do we need to rethink the way we define success in the United States and the tools for success? Do you feel like your profession, your educational level is looked down on? What would it take to get the dignity, the respect that people deserve, even if they don't have the four-year degree that's often seen as the ticket to success? Join in at 800-642-1234. We've got full phone lines. Let's go to your calls now. Rick is with us in Oshkosh. Rick, hello.
Hey, hello. Thank you. So I had a question from Paul. I'm going to try to really understand it. I'm getting a mixed sense from his conclusions as to whether the problem is a meritocracy or the problem is the humility of those that actually win. You know, I'm struck by what I feel is the mistake in making all kids a winner when there's a sporting event. Everybody gets a trophy, and we've tried to teach humility by essentially saying everybody's a winner instead of the harder work of saying there are people that will win in certain ways and other people will win in other ways, and we want to respect all of that. But I'm worried about throwing the baby out with the bathwater and saying the problem is meritocracy and we need to kind of level the playing field. So I'd love to get his thoughts on that, because I think one could really draw some exaggerated conclusions.
Rick, thanks a lot for the call. Michael, you talk about that humility issue. What do you think of what Rick had to bring up there?
Rick raises a really interesting question, and I would say this. I don't think... Well, let me start with the idea of humility. In the book, I write about humility as the civic virtue we need now, and I think it's in short supply. And the reason it's in short supply has to do with the attitudes towards success that many of the winners have come to adopt. And right at the center of those attitudes is the idea that my success is my own doing. This forgets the luck and good fortune that helped me on my way. A greater appreciation, Rick, of the role of luck in life can prompt a certain humility among the winners. And here I'm not talking about pretending that everyone is a winner by giving all of the kids an award regardless of how well they perform. That's not what I'm suggesting. But what I am suggesting is that we think hard about what counts as contributing to the common good. We often assume that the money people make is the measure of their contribution to the common good, but that's a mistake. So I'm saying we need to encourage greater humility among the winners, because if they recognize the elements of luck and good fortune in success, maybe they'll inhale a little bit less deeply of that success and be more open to a generous response toward those of their fellow citizens who may struggle, not because they're to blame, but because of the shape of the economy and the alternatives that have been put before them. That's what I have in mind. Another way of putting it is there are many ways of winning, and we have a tendency to collapse them all into the measure of money. And that's one of the things we need to rethink if we're to aim for a politics of the common good.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Dan with us now in De Pere. Dan, hi.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. Your guest, I think, is spot on. I remember 50 years ago, the heart of the Democratic Party was the blue-collar laborer. And now the impression is that they turn their nose up to these folks, and they've become the party of this liberal college elite combined with people that are dependent upon government charity and government handouts in order to get by. And you walk around see all the road signs of all these of union members, union members and former union members, because they broke the unions. There's Trump signs everywhere because they feel they've been left out of the Democratic Party. So I think he's spot on.
Dan, thanks for the call. I'll throw in one more group you point toward, Michael, successful people on Wall Street getting a lot of deference, you write, from presidents from the Democratic Party, for example.
Yes, it's interesting. And Dan, I think is on to an important point that blue-collar workers traditionally were right at the heart of the constituency of the Democratic Party. And increasingly, the Democratic Party has become the party of professional, well-educated elites, including large parts of the people who work in the financial industry. In 2008, Barack Obama raised more money from Wall Street than his Republican opponent. This was the first time that was true of a Democratic candidate for president. It reflects a shift that was underway during the decades of globalization, when the Democratic Party became more attuned to the professional classes, and this alienated, and the policies they enacted, deregulating finance, for example, during the last years of the Clinton administration, this contributed to alienating and the working class, blue-collar workers. And so Trump, who played to the anger and resentments that we've been discussing, was able to win a disproportionate share of white working class voters who lacked a college degree. And so I think the Democratic Party needs to reconnect with the dignity of work, with support for unions, and this means challenging its too easy association with the credentialed professional classes. It's been a very consequential shift. Dan is right about that. Interestingly, the same thing has happened to the Labour Party in Britain, to the Social Democratic parties in Europe. And it has to do, I think, with the way center-left parties they bought into the market-driven version of globalization that has played out in the last several decades.
Thanks for that call, Dan. We're talking to Michael Sandel about his new book, The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good. Let's go now to John on the line in Milwaukee. John, hello.
Hello. Listen, I think the last comment or call-in was on target, and yet I think we're building a false paradigm here that to say the Democratic Party has somehow lost sight of the working class. I mean, let's look at what actually has happened is that the Republican Party, Republican governors, Republican playbook has been to close, shut down, demoralize the unions, close them. It's a cost savings. Those unions, trade unions, were the heart and soul of this country and still should be. And they've been so denigrated and underfunded and cut in school programs, colleges, two-year colleges. The unions provided that training. They provided that kind of recognition of professional training and professional investment that is the heart and soul of our everyday life, our plumbing, our electricity, our homes.
John, thanks a lot for the call. Michael, Republicans and unions and how they fit into all this.
I think John is spot on. I agree with John completely that the Republicans have been hostile to unions and that unions are the heart and soul of this country, really, and of not only of the support for the economic prospects of working people, but also giving working people a meaningful voice in politics. So I don't want to be misunderstood. And if you read the book, this is clear. I am not in any way defending the Republican response to unions or their tax policies. I don't think that they represent the interests of working people in their policies. I don't think they have a persuasive program for the dignity of work. But that leaves a big question, Rob. And the question is this. If Trump's policies, if his economic policies, very few of them help working people with regard to health care, with regard to tax policies that give tax breaks disproportionately to millionaires and billionaires, why is it that even so, many working people support Trump and voted for him in 2016? That's the question. And my answer, the book really is an attempt to answer that question. And the answer I give has to do with the Democratic Party's embrace of market-based globalization, their role in deregulating the financial industry, their role in going along with Republicans.
And I'm going to jump in. We're going to pick up the conversation. We've got to listen to some news now. Michael Sandel is with us. His new book is The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good. Still time for you to join with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. More coming up with Michael Sandel. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our talk with Michael Sandel. He teaches political philosophy at Harvard University. We're talking about his new book. It's called The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234 with Don on the line in La Crosse. Don, hi.
Hi. I want to know about people that don't have a high school degree or diploma. I'll take my answer offline.
Don, thanks for the call. Michael, we talked about the college-non-college divide. How about people without that high school diploma?
They struggle even more in this economy, which is all the more reason why we have to invest in forms of learning and job training that can enable them to learn what they need to be able to flourish in the world of work. There's no reason we can't do this. But it's a matter of political will, and it's also a matter of broadening our concept of what it is to respect the different contributions that people make in this economy. I could just add one more thought, Rob. During this pandemic, we suddenly realize we can't help but notice how deeply dependent we are on the contribution of workers we often overlook. I'm not just speaking about those in the hospitals who are caring for COVID patients, but delivery workers, warehouse workers, truck drivers, home health care workers, workers in the gig economy who enable a lot of us to be able to work remotely. Now we're calling them essential workers, but these are not the best paid. Often they are not the most highly educated. And they are certainly not the most honored workers in our society. But I think our recognition now, during this crisis, of the importance of their contribution, we're calling them essential, after all, that could prompt a rethinking of the dignity of work and the way we reward, also the way we honor the various contributions that people make to our economy and to the common good, however credentialed or otherwise they may be.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Ben now in Northern Illinois. Ben, hi.
Hello and good afternoon. I wanted to talk about this from a slightly different perspective in looking at something that's kind of rampant in many levels of education, which is the sort of denigration and outright ignoring of learners who are referred to as kinesthetic learners. In other words, these are people who learn by virtue of physically actually doing something, as opposed to working with models and abstractions and perhaps acquiring information through strictly visual or auditory or some combination thereof. If you look carefully at, for example, in engineering, half the time you're worried about learning mathematics and science and other things, but as for actually doing something, as in building or constructing or something like that, this is not exactly on the plan, even though, in fact, you'll be doing a lot of that in the actual work itself, for an example. And there are also many other kinds of places where work that depends upon a kinesthetic learning base is actually devalued in the, you know, in the academic world, as a matter of fact.
Interesting. Ben, I want to jump in because we've got a lot of other callers waiting, but I think we take your point. Michael, we look down maybe on the things you can learn by doing as opposed to learning by being in a classroom.
Yeah, Ben makes a good point, and I need to learn more about that, but it certainly is a point that fits with the general concern I have about too narrow an understanding about what it means to equip people for success.
Thanks for that call. Alan joins us next in Eau Claire. Alan, hi.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'll try to be brief. There's way too much emphasis put on college nowadays because, you know, and you got to think about it. My dad told me years ago, he says, I don't care what you do with your life. He says, but no matter what, the world is always going to need ditch diggers. Ditch diggers being trades, plumbers, construction, working outside. Now, on top of that, ditch digging pays really good. And it gives you a great sense of being and wealth and self, you know, improvement. And it's also an essential job. My job was never threatened throughout this whole pandemic.
Alan, thanks a lot. The trades, in effect, Michael.
Yeah, Alan makes a great point. And we've got to find a way as a society to broaden our notion of respect, to encompass dignity and respect and appreciation for all of the jobs on which we depend, and whether engaging in trades or digging ditches, as Alan reminds us, these two are important contributions to the common good. And I have some suggestions in the book about policies that would prompt a public debate about this. For example, should we really tax earnings from labor, from real work, more than we tax earnings from interests and dividends? Should we consider wage subsidies for jobs that are important but that the market undervalues? What about reducing the payroll tax, which is a tax on ordinary labor, and making up the difference by a tax on financial transactions? These are some of the proposals I make in the book, not as a solution to these problems, but a way at least of beginning a debate about how we broaden our appreciation of the full range of jobs that contribute to the common good.
To follow up on that point, though, there are some jobs in some communities where I think people felt the same way. People are always going to need coal, so there's always going to be a job in the mine. People are always going to need paper, so there's always going to be a job in the local paper mill. And it might have been true for a couple generations. How do we cope, though, when either we shift from coal or we shift those plants to another state or another country? How do we account for those workers who, through really no fault of their own, have had that expectation upended?
Right. Well, that is a very serious question. And we, as we move from a carbon-based economy toward a green, more sustainable economy, we had better do it in a way that puts workers first, and that be, and at the very start of these policy transitions, asks how can we take advantage of the skills and the work experience of people working, say, in as coal miners, to provide them with the skills they need to contribute to the transition to a less carbon reliant economy. We can do that provided we start with with respect for those workers who have spent their lives in a coal mine, let's say, not think about them after we've already developed a nice blueprint for a green economy. We have to start with those who are doing the work and how to help them in a transition in a way that not only preserves their livelihood, but also accords them the respect they deserve.
We are talking to Michael Sandel about his new book, The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good. Let's bring on another caller. Christopher is with us in Appleton. Christopher, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Say, I see that folks, you know, historically have always voted against their economic interest, and I think it's getting deeper than that now. I think we have, after, you know, Newt Gingrich and the moral majority came in, the right has started to just side with the right, and they're going to vote not only against their economics, but a lot of other factors. And to just suppose that, I guess we'll say the social justice warriors on the left, and a lot of folks that are in the middle, I don't mean political, I just mean maybe aren't as concerned with the moral majority or aren't as concerned with social justice, kind of end up being left out of the conversation. And that's a huge, I think, a vast majority of people. And I think that is a product of the two-party system and folks just not feeling like they have anybody that truly represents them. And that's, you know, I think a problem of classism.
Right.
Interesting, Christopher. The two-party system, I don't think you'd argue, Michael, doesn't represent everybody.
Right. I agree with Christopher. I think that the two parties, both parties, have failed to speak to the things that matter most to a great many people. And I think that's why there's so much disaffection from the political system. I think that's why representative democracy is in trouble, why people are frustrated with the empty terms of public discourse. And so what I mean by a new politics of the common good is reshaping the terms of public discourse. Most of what passes for political discourse these days consists of shouting matches on talk radio or cable television where people don't really listen to one another. And one way we have to, I think, address this is to create more class mixing common places in public spaces in our everyday lives. We've increasingly separated our even ways of living on the basis of class. And that's not good for anybody because it deprives us of the chance to encounter one another and to realize that we're engaged in a common project as democratic citizens. There's a lot of work to be done in rebuilding class mixing institutions in everyday life.
In our last couple minutes, what could that look like? What is your vision for how we bring people together in common situations and hopefully make them realize that there is such a thing as a common good?
Well, part of the problem is that as inequality has deepened in recent decades, as we have relied more and more on markets to define the value of our contribution to the common good, those who are affluent and those of modest means increasingly lead separate lives. We live and work and shop and play in different places. We send our kids to different schools. But and democracy does not require perfect equality, but it does require that people come together from different walks of life in the course of everyday life, encountering one another, bumping up against one another, whether in sports stadiums or public transportation or health clinics or municipal centers or public parks or libraries, cultural institutions. This is what we need to rebuild, because unless this is how we learn, this is how we learn to negotiate and to abide our differences, and this is how we come to care for the common good. So we need to lean against allowing markets to define us and inequality to separate us, to recover the dignity of work, and also to open the space, the actual concrete practices of everyday life that will remind us that we are all in this together and that for all our differences, we need a politics that reaches for the common good.
Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. I really enjoyed it.
Michael Sandel teaches political philosophy at Harvard University. He was with us to talk about his new book, The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good.